Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Sound check on the radio. Sound check on the internet. Sound check with John Schaefer. He's the host.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. At the end of December, NPR asked me to fill out their end-of-year music survey. Since I'd already inflicted our own survey on a whole bunch of critics and some of you, I felt I couldn't say no. One of the questions was, what are you looking forward to next year? And I wrote, would it be too much to hope for something, anything new from David Bowie? Does that sound like I was whining? All right, yeah, I was whining, but come on, it's been 10 years since the guy's last record. But now, Bowie is back, and we'll hear his new single a bit later and get a couple of snap reviews from our listeners. If you've heard the song, you can leave yours right now on our voicemail, 1-866-939-1612. That's 1-866-939-1612. So, Bowie has a new album, due in March. Obviously, that's going to be big news. But will it be the biggest selling album of the year? Nah, probably not. In fact, I'm starting to wonder if anybody will ever unseat Adele, whose album 21 was the best-selling record of both 2012 and 2011. It's the first time one album has topped the sales charts for 2 years in a row since SoundScan began measuring and reporting on music sales back in 1991. So, can Adele go for the three-peat? Who are the challengers that can stop her? For answers to these and other burning music sales questions, we turn to our regular contributor Joe Levy of Billboard magazine. Joe, welcome back.
Good to be here.
So what does it say about the music business and the state of album sales that Adele has repeated as best-selling album of the year 2 years in a row?
Well, the first thing it says is that people really love Adele. This record has passed the diamond mark. That's 10 million sold. She's about 1.2 million away from being the 10th best-selling album of the SoundScan era. She would replace NSYNC's No Strings Attached.
Mm-hmm.
What does it say? It says that when you've got a hit and you've got people that, music that people really want to buy, they will buy it. It in and of itself doesn't say something bad about the music industry.
Uh-huh.
The problem that the music industry has is that there's nobody else selling at this level.
So who's buying all of these? Who are these 10 million plus people buying this record?
It's an excellent question, you know, and the key to the success of the Adele record, it is thought, is that it is new music that sounds like old music, so that it appeals to both a younger audience and an older audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the theory in the music industry is that when you have an album that 14-year-old girls want to buy for their moms and moms want to buy for their 14-year-old daughters, you've got a big hit on your hands because you've got a record that appeals to everyone.
Now, the second best-selling record of last year was Taylor Swift's album, Red. Adele sold 4.4 million copies. Taylor Swift sold 3.1, so she was pretty far off the pace, but still, leading a charge of what we would probably term country artists in the top 10, numbers 7, 8, 9, and 10, all by people associated with country. So what does that say about that particular segment of the music industry and that particular segment of music listenership?
The first thing you have to remember about Taylor's accomplishment is it may be off the mark that Adele is setting, but Adele had 12 months of 2012 to set that mark.
Right.
Taylor's album, out since September.
Mm-hmm.
And judged by that metric, that's a lot of records to sell in a small amount of time.
Ever. I'm really gonna miss you picking fights and me falling for it, screaming that I'm right. And you would hide away and find your peace of mind with some indie record that's much cooler than mine.
Again, the theory in the music industry is that country fans continue to buy music. This is a somewhat, what word should I use? chauvinistic? I don't know. It's looking down at country fans as not being digitally savvy enough to steal the music they want. In all honesty, the theory is that country fans buy CDs. If you look at the sales, you'll actually see country making big gains in digital this year, which means that the country audience is, one, both going more pop in the person of Taylor Swift. She's got a huge pop record on her hands, and she's got potential to reach well outside of the country audience. So still defined as a country artist when we're talking about it right here, right now, but right, reaching many, many more people. But also that Nashville-based record companies really are working hard to bridge what's thought of as country's music's digital gap.
And speaking of the kind of the pop country divide, I mean, at number nine, you have Lionel Richie, who, of course, crossed over from pop into country and sold over a million copies of his record called Tuskegee. Let's hear a little.
Fiesta forever. Come on and sing along. We go to party. Caramu. Fiesta forever. Come on. Come on and sing along. Right here.
That's a country version of All Night Long, an early Lionel Richie hit featuring Jimmy Buffett and taken from his album Tuskegee, the ninth best-selling record of 2012, over a million copies sold, and one of five country artists on the top ten. Joe Levy of Billboard magazine with us on Soundcheck, looking at the state of album sales over the past year. Before we get too far from the Adele record, we mentioned how that was the album of the year two consecutive years, 2011, 2012. First time that has happened since SoundScan began measuring album sales in 1991. Any sort of precursors to this before the SoundScan era?
Indeed, it's a very important precursor. The number one record 2 years in a row, set in the 1980s, Michael Jackson's Thriller. And it's no surprise that it did this. What's really interesting is that what it portends is the possibility that Adele is not going to set the scales, climb the heights that Thriller climbed, but that Adele is a pop phenomenon on a huge scale unseen since those days. And that does seem to be true.
Yeah. Now, the other thing is, with Thriller, that was the proverbial, you know, rising tide that floated all boats. I mean, you had a music industry, sales numbers were down, if you recall back then, and then, you know, Michael Jackson comes along and, you know, there's like a big boom in album sales. It doesn't seem like Adele's 21 has quite the same, you know, politicians would call it what, like a long tail, you know, coattails or whatever.
No, it doesn't seem that way this year. Remember that last year, if we go all the way back to 2011 and the year-end numbers we were looking at this time at the start of 2012, there was a slight increase in album sales.
Mm-hmm.
This year, there's a, by the standards of the record industry, modest decrease. You know, we've been in double-digit losses in the music industry for many years. This year, album sales fell about 4.4%.
Mm-hmm.
Is that good news? No, but it's also not the disaster that we've seen previously. And digital songs and digital sales continue to rise up every year. This year is no exception.
Right. So song downloads are up to 1.3 billion in 2012. That's up 5%. And the top three songs downloaded last year, well, at number three, the band Fun with We Are Young.
Tonight.
That's the band Fun. They sold just under 6 million copies of this song digitally, We Are Young. At number two, Carly Rae Jepsen, with almost 6.5 million copies of this summer classic. Call Me Maybe from Carly Rae Jepsen, the number two downloaded single of last year. And at number one, the Belgian-Australian singer Gautier with Somebody That I Used to Know. That was the number one downloaded song of 2012, 6.8 million copies of Somebody That I Used to Know by Gautier. Looking at the list, Joe, it seems like, you know, there are some rock acts, but they're few and far between. I mean, pop music is, of course, by definition, the popular stuff of the day. But to find real kind of a presence of rock music in any of the charts, you really have to start looking at vinyl, don't you?
Well, vinyl sales continue to increase modestly. I should say that vinyl sales account for a small portion of the overall sales of the record industry, but they've been on the rise year after year after year. And this year, the number one selling record on vinyl is Jack White's album, Blunderbuss. The number two selling record on vinyl, and Jack White sold about 30,000 more than the Beatles' Abbey Road. So people are still running out and buying Abbey Road on vinyl, about 30,000 people this year.
So what do you make of that? Are those audiophiles? Are they just older listeners? What do you think? What's the industry?
I think it's a combination of audiophiles and a combination of younger people who are taken with the idea of vinyl as a collector's item, as a talisman, and also as something that just sounds better. Certainly sounds better than MP3s, although there are people who will argue the difference between the CD and the vinyl. No one really argues the difference between the MP3 being played through your computer and the vinyl being played through your stereo.
Right.
People love their vinyl records.
And vinyl sales up 18%. I mean, it's only 4.6 million, but still up 18% last year. Three quarters of the vinyl bought were rock albums, and the top album, as Joe says, was this one from Jack White.
I was in the shower, so I could not tell my nose was bleeding. Dripped down my body to the floor, up and on my feet. Looked in the mirror of my face, I thought I had a disease. Yeah. And there's a woman with her fingers in my icebox. She peeped around the corner, asked me if I'm okay. She put the ice up on my tongue and then it melted away. All right.
Blunderbuss, top-selling album of 2012, vinyl album, that is, from guitarist Jack White. And as Joe Levy told us, number two was the Beatles' Abbey Road, which had previously occupied that top slot for a couple of years. Adele with the best-selling album, period, of 2012 and also of 2011. Any possibility that she could pull a Chicago Bulls on us and go for the three-peat this year?
No, she's not going to have the three-peat. I believe Taylor Swift is going to deny her that opportunity at every every moment of this year. Taylor's going to go on tour this year. She's got new singles loaded and ready. She was already well on Adele's pace with a record that just had 4 months to sell this year. She's got 12 months next year. She's almost a lock for the top slot of next year.
Wow. Okay, so we may be having a very similar conversation in January of 2014. Joe Levy of Billboard Magazine, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
You can watch Adele performing her hit song Rolling in the Deep on our website, soundcheck.org, recorded live in our studio back in February 2011. That's from our video of Adele performing a stripped-down version of Rolling in the Deep in our studio, one of the most popular videos we've ever posted, by the way. You can watch it at soundcheck.org. Stick around for another acoustic version of a smash-hit pop song from the R&B singer Miguel, and later an in-studio performance from the jazz violinist Zach Brock and your 30-second reviews of the new David Bowie song. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We were just talking with Joe Levy about the best-selling albums of 2012. This singer and songwriter, Miguel, didn't quite reach the multi-million-selling heights of Adele or Taylor Swift, but he did earn a lot of critical acclaim and sold over 500,000 downloads of this hit single, Adorn. Miguel's album, Kaleidoscope Dream, was on many best-of-the-year lists, and he ended the year with a stop at the offices of NPR Music in Washington, D.C. That's where NPR shoots those tiny desk concert videos that you may have seen of artists doing very stripped down, very cramped, but very intimate and fun performances. You can watch the full video of Miguel's tiny desk concert on soundcheck.org, but here's his unplugged version of Adorn, a song which is up for no fewer than 3 Grammys next month.
Baby, these lips are, can't wait to taste your skin. Baby, no more. And these eyes, can't wait to see your grin. Ooh, ooh, baby, just let my love, just let my love adorn you. Yeah, baby, and you gotta know, you gotta know that I adore you. Yeah, baby, and baby, these fists are, will always protect you, lady. And this mind, never neglect you. Yeah, baby. Ooh, ooh. And I stay trying to break us down. Don't let that affect us. No, no, baby. You just gotta let my love, live my love, let my love adorn. I let it dress you down. And you gotta know, gotta know that I adore you. Trust that, baby. Oh, let my love adorn you, baby. Don't you let don't you let nobody tell you different now. I always adore you. You gotta know. Gotta know now, the
same way that the stars are doing the skies, yeah. Look up, sugar. Now, hey, hey, hey. Same way that my whole world's in your eyes. Ooh, and it's time now. Just let my love, baby, do you. Hey, let it dress you down. You got to know, baby. Oh, you gotta know. Know that I do. Love ain't never looked so good on ya. Oh, put it on, baby. Let my love dawn. You. Thank you very much.
That's Miguel and Adorn, played live in the NPR studios, actually in an NPR office. You can watch the video of this Tiny Desk concert from NPR Music, which includes two additional songs, on our website, soundcheck.org. Now, NPR also published an end-of-year music survey where they asked some writers and critics and broadcasters a bunch of questions about music in 2012 and what to look forward to in 2013. As I mentioned at the top of the show, for the question about what I wanted to see in 2013, I wrote that if it wasn't too much to ask, I'd like to hear something, anything new, from David Bowie. I mean, it's been 10 years since his last record. In 2004, he had an emergency angioplasty to relieve a blocked artery in his heart while touring in Europe, and since then he hasn't toured either. So it was really beginning to look like maybe he was seriously thinking of retiring or something. Until yesterday. In case you haven't heard, Bowie released a new single yesterday, his 66th birthday, and announced that a new album is coming in March. The new song is called Where Are We Now, and it finds Bowie in a reflective mood. In fact, he's looking back at what many Bowie fans, this one included, feel was the high point of his career, his years in Berlin in the late 1970s, when he was making music that often veered towards that gray area where the rock and classical avant-gardes meet. So you'll hear him referring to streets and bridges in Berlin, but the sound here actually reminds me more of Thursday's Child from Bowie's 1999 album Hours. Both songs look back but refuse to live in the past. This new one is a beautiful song, a kind of haunted ballad, and it was an unexpected birthday present yesterday to Bowie fans everywhere. Here's Where Are We Now.
Had to get the train from Potsdamer Platz. You never knew that I could do that. Just walking the day. Sitting in the jungle, I remember the stars. A man lost in time near Cardiff, just walking the dead. Thousand people, crossbows and Buka, fingers are crossed just in case, walking the dead. Where are we now? Where
That's David Bowie's new single, released to general surprise and rejoicing yesterday, since many Bowie fans had begun to think we'd never get another album out of him. But this single, Where Are We Now?, will be followed by a full-length record in March called The Next Day. There's also a video for this song, which is kind of sad, a little unsettling, and very beautifully shot in the Berlin neighborhood where Bowie used to live. You can see it on our website, soundcheck.org. So, what did you think of it? First new Bowie song in 10 years, after all. Here's what some of you had to say.
Hi, my name is Veronica Lippincott from Highland Park, New Jersey. Love it, love it, love it. In my book, David Bowie Can Do No Wrong, I like the fact that, you know, he made a lot of references to Berlin, which, as we know, he spent latter part of the 70s there, where he was cleaning up from his substance abuse and trying to revitalize his career. And he produced a lot of great music at that time. And I think that at this juncture in his life, I think he's trying to revitalize his career again. And love the song. Look forward to hearing the rest of the album. And thank you. Bye.
Well, thank you, Veronica. Here's our listener, Alex, from Brooklyn, and her review.
I'm pretty excited for the new album, if it's going to sound just like this song, just because it's so subtle and beautiful. And I don't know, it's something new and different from Bowie, obviously. And hopefully the new album will sound just as beautiful.
All right, so Alex and Veronica both love the song. How about a couple of writers? The rock biographer Dave Thompson wrote about Bowie in his book, Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, The Dangerous Glitter of David Bowie, Iggy Pop, and Lou Reed. Here's his snap review.
Well, all I can say is I played it when I got up, and ever since I've had Give a Little Whistle from Pinocchio stuck in my head. Slow it down, remove the whistling, of course, and change the words to A Trip Around Berlin, and there you go. Looking forward to see what the rest of the album is like. I've never seen an elephant fly. Bye-bye.
All right. So Dave claims Where Are We Now sounds like this song from Pinocchio. Do you hear it?
When you meet temptation and the urge is very strong, give a little whistle, give a little whistle.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know. The music writer Chris Malanfi has a different and perhaps more apt comparison.
Not to be all Hollywood and reductive, this meets that, but the first thought that leapt to mind when I heard Where Are We Now this morning was it was like Bowie's own classic cover of Wild as the Wind from 1976's Station to Station. Meets a Radiohead ballad, something like Fake Plastic Trees.
For a fake Chinese rubber plant and a fake plastic girl.
The only difference, of course, is that unlike either of those two recordings, Where Are We Now doesn't soar. And that's intentional. It's a song that, when it isn't name-dropping sites from Bowie's adopted Germany, finds David brooding on his own mortality. basically, it's like he wrote a soaring ballad and then, when recording it, refused to soar. It gets deeper for me with each listen.
Fingers are crossed, just in case. Walking the dead.
Well, that was Chris Melanfi's response to this new David Bowie single. Chris writes about pop charts and contributes to NPR Music. Thanks to everybody who contributed their snap reviews of the new single, Where Are We Now, from David Bowie.
As long as there's sun, as long as there's sun.
Every week, our Check Ahead feature gives you a sneak peek at new music, but this week we're giving you an exclusive look at a new book. It's called Dinner with Lenny, The Last Long Interview with Leonard Bernstein. It chronicles Rolling Stone editor Jonathan Cott's conversation with Bernstein 1 year before the composer's death. This 12-hour visit at Bernstein's country home in Connecticut was fueled by vodka and asparagus hors d'oeuvres, and the conversation ranged from Stravinsky to Oliver Sacks to the Kabbalah to the Kinks. You can read an excerpt from Dinner with Lenny, this week's Check Ahead, on our website at soundcheck.org. Coming up, a young, up-and-coming composer. Jazz violinist Zach Brock and his quartet play live. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Jazz violin will forever be associated with the late great player Stefan Grappelli, who made his name alongside the guitarist Django Reinhardt. But for violinist Zach Brock, it wasn't just Grappelli's influence that drew him toward jazz as a youngster. Instead, it was a mohawk, a hairdo sported by the sax player Sonny Rollins. That really convinced him that jazz was cool. Zach Brock is now making a name for himself, playing alongside bassist Stanley Clark and sax player Chris Potter and others, and leading a few of his own ensembles. He's here today with one of them, the Zach Brock Quartet, and they'll kick things off with a live performance of this piece, Common Ground.
We'll be right back.
That is the Zach Brock Quartet with Zach's own piece called Common Ground. You'll find it on the album called Almost Never Was, which is out now. The Zach Brock Quartet featuring Zach on violin, Aaron Goldberg playing our piano, Eric Harland behind our drum kit, and Matt Penman playing his own bass. And Zach Brock, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. So I mentioned at the top of the segment that, you know, it was a mohawk, Sonny Rollins, that gave you the idea that, hey, this jazz thing could be all right. So what was that? Was that an album cover where he was like sort of precursoring Mr. T or something?
Yeah, yeah. It was one of those things that they were doing like in the late 70s and 80s where there would be some sort of illegal reissue and they would stick some picture from a totally different era. It was actually a reissue of all the sides that he did with Clifford Brown. But then, you know, they stuck a picture of him from like the early 60s on there. And I was kind of a rebellious teenager and, you know, was doing a lot of different stuff, classical violin. I was getting into playing guitar and playing skateboarding a lot, you know. Uh-huh. And my dad had this record set and I saw it and, it made a big impression on me. And fortunately, I also listened to the music.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much it after that.
So as a youngster, it sounds like maybe the battle wasn't between classical and jazz. It was between rock guitar and the classical violin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was, you know, going into adolescence, you know, I mean,
yeah.
I grew up hearing jazz in the household. My parents are musicians. My dad plays trumpet. My mom's a singer. And so there was, you know, stuff like that. And I sort of needed to find my rebellion
mm-hmm.
in music. And
mm-hmm.
so I sort of went in one direction and then kind of worked my way back.
Well, now, at what point as a violinist did you start? I mean, so many violinists never get past what they're taught and into the world of improvisation. At some point, you made that leap. When was that?
Yeah, you know, for me, I it was kind of a really natural thing because I grew up playing in a sort of a family band, family group. It wasn't sort of any one particular style, but I got into improvising when I was a kid. So it was sort of more, for me, like an additive process, you know, learning mm-hmm. how to improvise folk melodies, then having to learn the blues scale and deal with that. And then maybe adding, you know, an old school jazz tune, and then I got excited about it.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky.
So traditional American fiddle music, was that in the air then?
Yeah, definitely. That was in the air. I used to go to, you know, different sort of folk groups with my parents. We'd go out in the country and, you know, sit around a circle and play songs and stuff.
Mm.
But, you know, at the same time, it was something that I kind of also rebelled against rather than embrace. And, you know, I moved to Chicago and lived there for a long time, and it wasn't until I lived there for about a decade that I started to really appreciate some of the other stuff. So when people come up and ask me, like, oh, so you must play bluegrass and stuff like that, actually, I really can't, you know, and I say that out of the greatest respect to the great bluegrass players that
right.
I hear nowadays.
So right.
I don't know any tunes.
Again, Almost Never Was is out now from the Zach Brock Quartet. So, I mean, who are some of the other big figures for you? Was it Grappelli? Was it Joe Venuti? You know, the kind of standard jazz violin legacy?
For sure. Especially coming from a classical background, I immediately warmed to Stefan Grappelli. I think that, you know, I call him like the perfect gateway drug because, you know, there's actually not a lot of non-classical aesthetic that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's playing great, you know, amazing violin. You know, the technique and the tone and everything is very European.
It's not so far from like Fritz Kreisler,
right?
Or, you know, early 20th century Viennese fiddling.
That's right. That's right. You know, lots of, you know, lush, rapid, wide vibrato and stuff like that. You know, I think that as I got more into it, as I was listening to these Sonny Rollins sides that we were talking about, I started going out to jam sessions and I had, you know, there were like the old cats, which were the college students at the time, were telling me like, oh, hey, you know, man, you know, we see here you are, you're back again. You know, you're kind of into this. And, you know, are you checking out Miles Davis? Are you checking out this and that? Because, you know, I would want to learn a tune like four or something like that. But all of my language and all my phrasing was Grappelli. So I had to actually kind of shut that out for mm-hmm. a long time because it was, you know, a really strong influence and had to really, really just listen to players of other instruments
right.
for
so,
a long time.
So, you know, Sonny Rollins, a sax player,
definitely.
Miles, a trumpeter, et cetera.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Zach Brock. The next tune you're going to play for us is the Hendrix song, Drifting.
talking about, you know, looking at other players. I mean, Hendrix and the electric guitar certainly inspired a lot of other music and a lot of other instrumentalists. Was he in the pantheon for you too?
Oh, huge. He was really, really huge, because when I started checking out rock and roll, I was like a classical music kid. I didn't check out pop music. I didn't check out rock or anything until I was literally like, you know, 11, 12 years old. Mm-hmm. Actually, there was, I think some friends, you know, got a cassette tape of Thriller, and that was maybe like one of the first things I started really, you know, checking out. And so Hendrix, well, you know, I was checking out my parents' Beatles collection, and I really liked that. But when I discovered Hendrix, because I was also starting to get into playing the guitar a little bit, that was just a really mind-blowing experience for me, and I went deep into that for a long, long time.
Well, and you went deep into his catalog, because the cover is a fairly obscure Hendrix song called Drifting. Let's hear some more live music.
All right, thanks.
It's Zach Brock and his quartet playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio with a song called Drifting, live on Soundcheck. Due to rights issues, we are unable to podcast this performance from today's show, but the good news, you can stream the entire performance and interview at soundcheck.org. The Zach Brock Quartet, live on Soundcheck with their version of a posthumous Jimi Hendrix song called Drifting. Zach Brock playing the violin, Aaron Goldberg playing the piano, Matt Penman on bass, and Eric Harland behind the drum kit. And Zach, I said violin, I could have said violin plus, because as Hendrix did with his guitar, you've got the foot pedals and stuff, so
yeah.
That's part of the violinist arsenal these days, I guess?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And, you know, it can be a touchy subject because, you know, sometimes, you know, when we put a violin through effects, it's kind of instantly sort of puts people in a certain mindset. I understand that. But I actually am kind of, at this point, kind of drawing inspiration from what I hear a lot of jazz players doing and splitting the signal between an acoustic sound and also the affected thing. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of horn players do that these days,
right. And
that's cool. But, you know, sometimes if you just want to go full-on effects and, you know, you do that. So
if you're doing Hendrix, why not?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of need more, actually, for that.
The album is called Almost Never Was, the Zach Brock Quartet. The album's out now. Zach, it's been a real pleasure having you in the band here with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
This is Soundcheck. Going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow, join us at 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org for a live performance by the indie pop band Ra Ra Riot. They'll give us a sneak preview of songs from their upcoming album Beta Love and play live in the studio. You can hear it live at 2 p.m. Eastern
on soundcheck.org. Then on the air at 9, The Story of Punk Magazine, which chronicled the punk movement and turned its writers, artists, and cover stars into underground heroes. We'll talk with Punk Magazine's founding editor, John Holmstrom. Plus, the Brooklyn-based Bhangra party band Red Bharat joins us to play live in the studio. Join us again at 9 tomorrow for another Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer.